Welcome back to the Al Franken Show. My guest in studio right now is Glenn Greenwald, author of How Would a Patriot Act? And this is a bestseller, Defending American Values from a President Run Amok. And it actually has an interesting story behind how this became a bestseller, because it really, Glenn, did it through the blogosphere and word of mouth.
Almost exclusively, that's right. We only conceived of the idea for the book in February. I talked to someone from Working Assets Publishing, and they were a large telephone company which was creating a publishing company for the first time, and proposed that we publish a book about the theories of presidential power that this administration has adopted and the ways in which it's radical and dangerous. And we wanted to do it very quickly so that it could be tied to current events. And we basically produced the entire book from conception of the idea to having it in people's hands in about 3 months.
And that's really incredibly fast.
That's very fast. Mm-hmm. And it really, what we did was, before it was released, we sent it to maybe 7 or 8 bloggers, influential large bloggers, and asked them to read the galleys and if they were interested to talk about the book. And they all did. And based just on that,
and they did because they knew you as a blogger.
They knew me as a blogger, and then also, you know, bloggers are pretty notorious for not handing out compliments unless they really mean it, even mm-hmm. to people whose work they might like in the past. And so they read it and they promoted it really enthusiastically. And the day they did, it went to number one on Amazon, just based on those, you know, handful of bloggers before the book was even released, and it stayed there for the whole week. And since then, it's gotten very little.
And you did this without saying something incredibly ugly and inappropriate.
Yeah, I think the tone of the book is is not to, you know, label people godless or talk about how they revel in the deaths of their spouses, but it's to present as objective a case as possible based on, you know, indisputable facts is what this administration is doing.
Okay, and basically the overall thesis is what? That there's, in this administration, there's been an expansion of executive authority that's dangerous.
Right. Not just dangerous, but really unprecedented. That mm-hmm. there's a lot of scandals that get sort of isolated attention in the media. There's the torture scandal, the eavesdropping without warrants, the detention of U.S. citizens without a trial. All of these things get discussed. But what doesn't get discussed in the media is the fact that they have a common root, which is that the Bush administration has expressly adopted the theory that the president is vested with literally unchecked power with regard to all matters concerning national security, including what the government can do to U.S. citizens on U.S. soil. And those theories are entirely alien to the core principles of our government and unprecedented in terms of any other administration.
Now, they, even before we went to war, they were, for example, their secretiveness was sort of unprecedented, wasn't it?
Well, I think so. I mean, the thing that you know, the point I make in the book is, just like there were ideologues in the administration who wanted to go to war in Iraq before 9/11 and then use that as an excuse or a pretext to do it, these theories, including this huge wall of secrecy and this sort of fetish for keeping things secret, as well as these executive power theories, existed among the sort of radical ideologues like the Dick Cheney, Don Rumsfeld circle and their followers. And it was really the September 11th attacks that let them institute these policies to an extreme that was beyond their wildest dreams. But you're right. You saw signs of it before 9/11 with the Energy Task Force and other instances where they made clear that they really believed that what they did was not something that ought to be known or disclosed or talked about among citizens in the media.
Yeah, they don't sort of believe in sunshine is the best disinfectant.
Right. They know best, and we ought to trust them in terms of making the right decisions, and there's no reason we need to know about them.
Let's talk about these, if you want to, one by one. The NSA wiretap. Now, this was clearly a violation of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act.
Clearly. I mean, the law says, as clearly as you can say it, that it is a criminal offense punishable up to 5 years in prison for anyone, including government officials, to eavesdrop on Americans without court approval and court warrants. That's what the law as clearly as you can
say it. It's pretty simple. And their argument, Gonzalez's argument for the Judiciary Committee, was pretty feeble, I thought.
Well, the argument is when it comes down to it, the real argument is that under our Constitution, the president has the obligation to defend the country, and therefore Congress cannot interfere with the president's decisions in that regard. And to the extent that FISA limits what the president can do, it's an unconstitutional incursion into presidential power, and therefore the president has the ability to ignore it. They have a secondary argument that Congress authorized the president to violate the law with when they authorized him to use military force in Afghanistan. But they've essentially – that seems to be a consensus even among Senate Republicans that that argument is frivolous. And so they're relying upon that first argument, that constitutionally you can't limit the power of the president, that he has unrestrained and unlimited power, the power of a king in essence, and that no one can check his decisions.
When we're at war. And it's up to him to determine it. In other words, it's up to him to determine the constitutionality of it, which means as long as he thinks something is constitutional in his powers as a commander-in-chief, he can do it.
Precisely. That as long as he thinks that there's – and it doesn't even depend upon the nation being at war. I mean, even Gonzalez said many times, including at the Judiciary Committee, that there's been no declaration of war. I mean, the Constitution says that Congress shall declare war. There's been no declaration of war either with regard to Iraq.
That's why I thought the authorization to use force was the number one actual rationale for this.
Well, keep in mind one thing, though, that's interesting is when President Bush in October 2001 ordered eavesdropping without any judicial oversight, ordered it to be done in secret. The only argument that the Justice Department had was this Article II constitutional theory that the president could do whatever he wanted in the area of national security. It wasn't until 2004 when Ashcroft and some of the other high-level appointees in the Justice Department began to say that there's no real legal authority for doing that, did they then stumble upon the argument that this authorization to use military force justified the violations of FISA. So that was an after-the-fact justification. What it began as was the view that the president, although FISA prohibits it, has the right to order things that he thinks is in the national interest, even if the American people have banned it through their Congress.
Now, the research group of Congress, the nonpartisan research group, has decided that this is unconstitutional.
Right.
The NSA wiretapping.
Right. They treated the administration's legal arguments with, I wouldn't say a disrespect, but certainly with a very aggressive opposition that's unusual for them. They usually are very moderate in their approach, and that's how they keep their nonpartisan nature. But we don't have a system of government where there is such a thing as unchecked or absolute power that can't be limited or regulated by the other two branches. That's the basic principle of how our government was structured. And the Congressional Research Service said as much in lawyerly and respectful language, but still very aggressively, that these theories simply don't exist in our system of government.
And Congress, what has Congress been doing about this? Because it seems like there's been a little bitching and moaning from Congress, but ultimately, they won't pull the trigger when it comes to standing up for their own prerogatives.
Right. There's been a tiny little bit of increased criticism, but it's purely rhetorical and semantic, and it never is followed up with action. And that really is the most alarming and dysfunctional part of this whole thing, which is what the founders counted on was that the way that the president's power would be checked is that Congress would fight for its prerogatives and power, the judiciary would fight for its, and the president would fight for his, and through that would be a balance that would result. And yet the president's allies have controlled Congress virtually throughout his entire tenure, and when the Democrats did, they were just as deferential to the president as the Republicans were in the wake of 9/11.
Well, they controlled the Senate for
about a year, and it was right after 9/11, and they did all they could to show unity, which meant, you know, giving the president the powers that he wanted. And so what's amazing about that, though, is when the president says that I have the obligation or the prerogative to violate these laws, the laws that he's talking about violating are the laws that were passed by the Senate. I mean, FISA was passed by a vote of 95-1 30 years ago.
And by the House.
And by the House almost as overwhelmingly. By the Congress and signed into law by the president. And so when the president says that I have the right to violate the law in the area of national security, he's really telling the Congress, you are irrelevant. You have no role to play in our system of government other than to make suggestions that are optional. And
now, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I wanted to go to these signing statements that the president has not vetoed any piece of legislation, but he kind of seems to not have to veto anything because he issues these signing statements. Take the amendment that banned torture.
Mm-hmm.
And then he signs a signing statement saying he signs the bill, announces that he signed the bill, but he has a side letter saying, oh, by the way, I can torture people if I want.
Right. That's a perfect, the signing statement, the torture amendment is the perfect example, because what happened was there were revelations that we became a country that used torture. We had a vigorous debate over that. Senator McCain introduced legislation to ban torture. Cheney vigorously lobbied against it. The president threatened to veto it. And it was passed by a vote of 90-9 in the Senate, mm-hmm. and almost overwhelmingly in the House. And so the president was forced to sign it into law, because had he vetoed it, it would have clearly been overridden. But as you say, the signing statement that he issued the very day that he signed it said that under our theory of government, under our system of government, I am not compelled to comply with the prohibitions on torture. And his top aides said to anonymously to the papers that he hoped to comply but didn't have to.
Now, it seems to me now the president has the authority to go to my house, knock down my door, and slap my wife around.
Right. I mean,
let's say she Googled roach bomb.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and had the word bomb in it. And the president, if he was in Minneapolis and was close enough, you know, knew where our apartment was, and they'd know where it is, he could come up and slap Franny around.
Without question. That the theories that they've adopted would unquestionably justify his doing that to her if he simply said that she was working with terrorists or that doing so would aid and benefit our national interests.
If he just said that.
Right, just by him. I mean, this is they've already detained and abducted U.S. citizens on U.S. soil and put them in military prisons without charging them with crimes and left them there for 3.5 years. Certainly these theories would justify that as well. There are no limits to the
And he
power.
Could send my – he could also at the same time send my kids to Uzbekistan to be tortured, right?
Sure. I mean, no one can interfere with his powers.
And guy, everybody listening out there, guys, don't let the president slap your wife around. You know, let him slap Alberto Gonzalez's wife, you know? Don't let him send your moms out there listening. Don't let the president – the president should not have the right to send your kids to be boiled in Uzbekistan. Let's stand up, everybody, right?
I mean, you know, it sounds extreme, and it sounds – when you say that there are no limits, it sounds like it's hyperbole. But the administration itself says there are no limits on what the president can do. And it's not just this president. It's subsequent presidents as well. We could have a next president who's more extreme than this current president.
Yeah, that's very likely.
I think so, and the last thing you want is a theory.
I don't think that's very likely.
Well, I mean, it depends. But, you know, with these theories in place that say that the president has powers that can't be checked, those powers are not going to be easily taken away once the executive office
exactly.
has them.
Exactly. And I often say that the Bush doesn't realize that the next president may not be as benevolent as him.
Right.
And I say it was a little bit of a wink.
Right.
We're talking to Glenn Greenwald. He's written a bestseller, How Would a Patriot Act, Defending American Values from a President Run Amok. And we'll continue this conversation when we return with the Al Franken Show here on Air America Radio. Welcome back to the Al Franken Show. Glenn Greenwald is the author of How Would a Patriot Act, Defending American Values from a President Run Amok. He's also the creator and writer of the political blog Unclaimed Territory, and he joins us here in the studio. You talk in the book about fear and fear-mongering, and it seems like this administration has just invested their entire foreign policy is the war on terror. In fact, last week, there was a lot of that resolution that came, you know, in the Congress that resolved that Iraq is a battleground in the war on terror, and of course it wouldn't have been if we didn't attack it.
Right.
And it seems like the way they're conducting the war on terror sort of ignores our other responsibilities in foreign policy, and also the missed opportunities we've had by going into Iraq.
Right. I mean, I do talk about that in the book a lot, because one of the questions that I ask is how can policies and actions by our government that are so plainly contrary to what our country is about, not have provoked a greater backlash and a greater sense of outrage among the citizenry. And I think the answer to that is that the one tactic that they've used over and over is exploiting and exaggerating the fear of terrorism so that the population believes that their very survival rests upon giving full power to the administration. And what they do in virtually every speech is they depict terrorism as this unprecedented threat, unlike any that our country has faced before. And I think it worked for a while, but I think that with the emotional distance that we have between now and September 11th, people are starting to realize, especially throughout the country, that on the list of things that threaten their lives and their children and that are important to them, the risk of a terrorist attack is nowhere near the top of the list, that it is a danger along with all sorts of other dangers, but doesn't want our country devoted exclusively to that threat. And I think that tactic is working less and less.
Yeah, I mean, the vice president, in his interview with Sean Hannity last Friday, did that thing of you haven't seen it's no accident that we haven't had a terrorist attack.
Right.
And it's basically just completely give us the right to do anything, and this is justified by that.
Right. No matter what question you ask them with regard to their actions, they answer with the terrorism threat, no matter how patently dishonest it is. And the best example is with the warrantless eavesdropping. I mean, the FISA structure was intended to exist so as to allow and promote aggressive eavesdropping. The easiest thing to do under the FISA law is to eavesdrop on terrorists, because every FISA judge will rubber stamp every request to eavesdrop. And the only thing that eavesdropping without warrants does is it doesn't increase the ability to eavesdrop. It just allows you to eavesdrop in secret so nobody knows what you're doing. And yet if you say to them, why is it necessary to eavesdrop without warrants, they will say, if Al-Qaeda is calling into the United States, we want to know what they're talking about, implying that in the absence of breaking the law, they can't eavesdrop on Al-Qaeda.
Yeah,
of course they can.
And you don't understand why they can't just go and get a FISA warrant to do that. And they can. So there's something fishy.
Right. The only thing that it accomplishes is allows them to eavesdrop in secret. And yet, you know, they want to obfuscate the fact that they're breaking the law or that they have claimed these powers. And so no matter what you ask them, they invoke Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda and the prospect that they won't know what terrorist actions are being planned in order to just disseminate as much fear as possible so that nobody pays attention to the issues. And aside from how dishonest it is, if you take a country and purposely impose fear on the population to the greatest extent that you can, it really begins to change the kind of country that you have. It changes your national character for everybody to be motivated by a desire to avoid risk as the number one public policy concern. And yet that's what mm-hmm. they've done to this mm-hmm. country for the last 5 years. And I think it can become irrevocable if it isn't reversed.
What's odd to me is that in the meantime, they aren't even sincere about that. Because if you look at what happened with Katrina, that could just as well have been a terrorist attack as a hurricane. And boy, were we not ready for that.
Right.
And that continues to be the case.
Right.
And they're cutting funds to first responders, and they're not trying to make the radio wavelengths interoperable. They're not doing the stuff that you would do if that was your main concern.
Yeah, if you say to them, why are we inspecting such a minute portion of the cargo that enters this country, they'll say because it's too expensive to inspect more, and yet the amount of money that we spent on this wild goose chase in Iraq would dwarf the amount of money needed to inspect all of the cargo, let alone significantly increased amounts of it. And so,
what is it now, $8 billion a month?
Yeah, it's something like that. And Jack Murtha just talked about it on Meet the Press that, you know, even if the best case scenario is true, that we can just stay and stay and stay and keep everything the same, not improve it, but keep it the same, which is the best we can hope for, we're draining not just our current financial capabilities, but our future capability as well for either hoping to keep it the same or making it worse. But again, their answer to that is terrorism, and we fear terrorism and therefore need to stay there. It's really their answer to everything, to engage in these fear-mongering tactics.
Okay, well, it's a lot to think about. Book, How Would a Patriot Act, Defending American Values from a President Run Amok. Thanks a lot, Glenn.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.